Darlene Cohen is speaking on April 4th, 1995 at Zen Hospice on the topic, Pleasure is Spiritual Practice.
And I often say the topic of suffering and delight is one that concerns us all. In these books, I usually talk about the problem of chronic pain and the various strategies that people might use to get through their whole life. That's what's involved with their pain, or through a very dire situation. So I talk about pain strategies and things like that, whether physical or psychological chronic pain. And I also talk about pleasure, observing your pleasure, noticing that you might have pleasure, even in the midst of terrible suffering, and to be able to expand that pleasure into your pain. And I don't mean distracting yourself from pain or chasing away pain, but just allowing your pain to interpenetrate in the same way that the form interpenetrates emptiness. Dark interpenetrates light, and death interpenetrates love. In that way, the reason I talk so much about pleasure and that I would like to talk to you about it this evening is because, well, hardly anybody does. I mean, you can't. I mean, it's not that it's such a big deal, it's just that nobody mentions it. And so, it's a dirty job. I have to take it on. And you might think, oh, she's wrong. You know, there's a great deal made of pleasure in our culture. TV commercials, magazine ads, the general frivolity of our culture. But that's not quite what I mean by pleasure, and I'll explain more as I go along. I think it's true that in our culture we're very much encouraged to consume, which is different than being encouraged to have pleasure. We're encouraged to buy new cars and overextend our credit cards and buy gadgets and play with our gadgets and then replace them with new gadgets. But I don't think that we're actually encouraged just to do things for the bald enjoyment of it. For instance, I don't think that we really get permission to put our physical inclination, to dance, to sleep, or to play before our various duties. We're not encouraged to do that. And you know very well that it's rude. It's not acceptable to stretch or to yawn or to move your hips in public. I mean, you wouldn't believe when I used to do my hip exercises at bus stops to spend the time in a good way, you wouldn't believe it, or you would believe the looks that I got. I would never be mugged. Nobody wants to fool with somebody who's doing that in public. So I think that there's still a bit of feeling against indulging yourself, and any drug that you take just to increase your pleasure, rather than for a medicinal reason, it's relieve pain, instantly outlawed. We're not allowed to take drugs for pleasure in our culture. So I think I actually do have to say something about that. I don't think we can take it for granted in our culture that we are permitted to have it. And I think that just plain old enjoying ourselves gets a bum rap. Especially if this enjoyment involves physical body. Especially if it involves the body. I think we're still pretty puritanical in our culture. We demand the firing of a certain general who won't condemn the execution. I think the Pope recently actually came out against yoga and meditation specifically because they're body-based. Specifically for that reason. Our bodies are considered kind of dangerous, still. If you sink in pure body and feel its sensual being, its sensations which are your law. That's a very dangerous thing to do with them. So we still have a remnant of that prejudice against physicality. And I think that pleasure is painted with the same paintbrush, which is proven that sensuality. Also, as Jack Kornfield has pointed out, that many people, when they begin a spiritual path, find that they're so judgmental of themselves and everything else, that already they're in a battle against themselves. When people start out on a spiritual path, when they start having this God spiritual path as a measure for what they're doing, they're instantly in a battle with themselves. So maybe what we need is kindness and permission to have fun on the spiritual path rather than to try to struggle in that way. So I'd like to talk about some issues involved in the practice of pleasure as a practice, and I'd like to talk about the taking of pleasure. First, I have to say a few words about the relationship between pleasure and pain. They're interdependent, you know that. They only have meaning in relation to each other. You can't conceive of pain without pleasure, or pleasure without pain. Your understanding of each of them is totally based on having experienced the other one. They're one of little pairs. There are a lot of these little pairs. Life and death, and life and dark and light, and sickness and health. All those little pairs. You pluck one of them out of the undisturbed world, the other one always follows. This can be disconcerting. Sickness and health is, as a body worker who works closely with people with chronic illness, that's a realm that most of my clients and I are very involved in. So to give you an example of what I mean by this little care. When I was very sick with rheumatoid arthritis and spent most of my time in bed, when I began to feel some stirring of energy, some focus going on in my body, some little tendency, and I began to spend more and more time out of bed, I got on this karmic wheel of sickness and health. Every morning when I woke up, I asked myself, do I feel better or worse than I did the morning before? So I was either plunged into despair and disappointment, if the answer was, I feel better, or uplifted and encouraged and elated if I felt better than the day before. So because I was emotionally involved with the answer to my question, I was very repelled by my disease, and I clung to every sign that I might be getting better. Because I was emotionally involved with the answer to that question, as I say, I was either elated or dejected. But you don't have to be very, very sick to get on that same wheel. All you have to do is just decide to improve your health. You can just say, well, I need to lose weight, I need to change. And starting right now, I'm going to start taking vitamins, I'm going to work out, I'm going to watch my diet, and you can go on the same trip that I did. At first, everything goes very well. Your clothes fit better, you get on the scale, and sure enough, every day, you lose a little bit of weight, or you run further than you did last week, and things go very well. But after a while, you notice when you're not feeling as well as when you're feeling very well. You might overtrain one day, and the next day you have to make some changes. Or you go to a party one night and indulge yourself, and the next morning on the scale there's 1 or 2 pounds more, and it drives you crazy. It was one little deviation from your regime. He didn't realize when he plucked feeling better out of his voice, that noticing feeling worse would come with him. So anyone who gets very involved with the relative state is very vulnerable to this cycle. And it's not your decision to change yourself that's the problem. It's your attachment to the outcome. So the real difference between pain and pleasure is the emotion they elicit. Repelled by pain, attracted to pleasure. If you go around the cycle often enough, up and down, in and out, around and around, disappointed, elated, sick, well, successful, failure, whatever your particular thing is. Then you notice, you see the essential unity of yourself set. They have the same source, the same truth in their consciousness. Neither one of them can stand alone. They only have meaning in relation to each other. It's the emotion that you put on them that makes them so significant in your life. And to further complicate the relationship between pain and pleasure, is that we can have both aversion and clinging to both pain and pleasure. I mean, this can get very muddy and very complicated. Or one can change into the other quite suddenly, actually. Where does one end and one start? Too much of a good thing. For instance, in my suffering and delight workshops, we start out by acknowledging our pain. So somebody will be talking about this great suffering, and joy will suddenly come in. And it's very embarrassing to be in the midst of describing this great tribulation, and there's this light feeling that comes over you, and it turns out that human beings actually get joy from acknowledging their pain. So where does one end and the other start? Or if you go to a feast, like a wedding, and the table piled with delicious things to eat and drink, and you just thought, give yourself complete permission on this special day to pig out and you can eat and it's so delicious and it's great and it's bright and it's terrific and oh, this and that and all the food flows into each other, all the colors. If you're a sensual person, you get a great deal of pleasure seeing food available on the table. But after a while, you're eating and eating, and you suddenly, or not suddenly, but you gradually get a kind of leaden, bloated feeling, and when the music starts, you don't feel anything. You don't feel good, you feel bad. So pleasure turns to pain. And at exactly what work for? It was the precise moment when it turned. And the opposite in that minute. And in the matter of lovers, you know that the very thing you're attracted to when you first meet somebody is the thing that drives you crazy after you've been with them for a while. I have a girlfriend, she met this man, she said, oh, he's wonderful, he's silent, he's strong, he's sensitive, he doesn't talk too much. You know, 3 months later, she's screaming over the phone, he never tells me his feelings, he never drives me crazy. But it's not him, it's her. She plucked that out of the void, out of the 10,000 characteristics about this person. She plucked that out. She got attached to it, and now she goes around the cycle. Sometimes he's silent, handsome, other times he's not sharing. It's the same character. So the problem with pain is aversion. The problem with pleasure is clinging. But of course the solution is just to live your life. Just be alive for all the moments, good, bad, or neutral. Not to decide which moments you're going to be alive for and which pains or suffering or whatever don't deserve your attention, so you'll just numb out. Or it's too boring. It's not even real suffering. It's just boring. You just be numb. If you do live your life without making that kind of preference, you state of mind. That's dropping body and mind. That's taking care of the body. Listening to all the feelings flowing in and out of this intelligence. Not making a separate being. It's everything as it is instead of aggregating experience. What I mean by that, I give arthritis workshops from time to time. I take carrots and a knife because people with arthritic hands often feel that they can't chop carrots or chop vegetables in general, and carrots are the hardest thing to chop. So I take, you know, this bushel of carrots, a knife and a cutting board, and you know, immediately people look at this when I set it up and say, I can't cut carrots, I haven't cut carrots for years. That's aggregating experience. That's lumping it all together. But when I have each person step up to the cutting board and take the knife from the mystery, feel the weight of the knife, feel the hand, how it place the carrot on the cutting board, raise the hand, lower the hand, move the grip, grasp the handle of the knife. That's the smooth motion. And most likely, any person with arthritic hands can do that. I can use that carrot aggregate experience today. So, if you live in discrete motion, when you come up against a challenge, it's much easier to get through. Everything is a gift. This is actually, I think, a skill to be acquired to look at this. When I work with people also with arthritis who can't put dishes in the cupboard, actually, I find that people can, if they lift a plate into the cupboard and then rest their arms coming down, and then up into the cupboard, break up the task into effort or relief. Actually, people don't get exhausted. Even very quickly, they don't get exhausted by the task that they have to do. In fact, when I was first learning to walk again after having arthritis, I lived at 340 and had to go down to the Stem Center fairly often. And I found, and always exhausted me, that little trip, that half-block trip. But I found if I focused, you know, when you walk, one of your feet is coming down, working, but the other foot is in the air, resting. This is from the point of view of the joint, or from the muscle point of view, this is working. But from the point of view of the joint, this is resting, you have your foot in the air while the other foot is down. Well, I found, just by focusing on the lifting of the foot, I had much more stamina. It was the same walk, but I focused on the resting rather than the impact of the foot. Again, this pre-motion instead of aggregating the skills. You can look at path that way. It is a skill to acquire. And it feels like, what it feels like when you do that is it's doing itself. You're out of the picture. The path does itself. So when you do things, including improving your health, there's an aspect of struggle. Not I can't cut carrots, I can't walk. It's using your creativity to figure out how to place it, the task. And so what really is going on in a situation like that, if you're doing what needs to be done, it's not you against the pain, against sickness, or anything else. It's not preferring a state of mind, one state of mind over another. Because if you do prefer one state of mind over another, you lose your ability to be present in your state of mind. Even if you're having intense pleasure, you might not be able to make a lot. And you're thinking, will we be able to do this again before one? Or eating. A friend makes a terrific special birthday dance for you when you're wondering what the next course is. You actually lose your ability to practice if you don't make it a practice. Or as Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, you're constantly sucked away from the work of life. So if you do notice, oh, I'm going to start watching my watch because it's so ungood. If you do notice your cycle of craving and aversion, and regard it with some humor and attachment, then you can begin to pursue the disinterested pursuit of pleasure. You and again practice the distinguishing between pleasure and pain. This is not the same thing. You can pursue pleasure in the same way that you eat sensibly or you put on a jacket when it's cold. This is just something you do because it makes sense to you. And why should you pursue pleasure? Because it's good for you. Pleasure is biochemically superior to pain. In fact, certain kinds of pleasure, certain kinds can actually boost your immune system. And certainly, when you're having pleasure, you breathe more deeply. Your muscles are relaxed so that when you move your joints, they gently pull your joints apart rather than crunching them together. And you're all tense. So you might not get arthritis. Pleasure is a very good thing for your health. It produces a very different blood chemistry than pain. This is kind of the fact. But most importantly, from a Buddhist point of view, pleasure makes you a very kind and generous person. That's even more important than the opposite. Because if you feel bounty, if you feel like your needs are met, then you naturally want to share the overflow with other people. This is true generosity. It's not personal. And you feel it. And I imagine people in this room who are volunteering in the hospice know what I'm talking about. The difference between generosity and social connection. As Aiken Roshi puts it, Robert Aiken Roshi, life is a wallet stuffed with $100 bills, and you have no thought of picking it up and putting it into your pocket. This is a broad and generous spirit of letting be, according to him. This is the perfection of choice. It's a revolution. This kind of thinking is a revolution that overturns things. And the reason I know, personally, the difference between generosity and social convention, although I've heard so many of I considered myself a very generous person. I mean, I always gave to people on the street. Whenever anybody asked me to help them with anything, I always said yes. But once I was a sensei, the demand was so constant, so extreme at every moment that I started resenting helping people. I mean, I saw how thin the veneer of politeness was. I mean, very soon, after living in I didn't want to help anymore. I started hiding out. And you know, whenever I had to go to the bathroom or go to the kitchen or something, I was caught. And I really resented doing the dishes or whatever it was that had to be done. And after a while, the gap between what I actually felt and the behavior that I continued to demonstrate got so huge that I actually had to deal with it. So I decided to do a selfishness test. And I went to my teachers in Augustine without permission and set out on my selfishness test. And here's what it was. Whenever the cookies were passed around at tea time or anything, I was very careful to take the largest one. Whenever anybody asked me to help them with anything, I always said no. And you'd be surprised how hard this is at first. But then you really can get in. So I practiced. Oh, and I was put to the test, believe me. I was put to the test. God, if I could just go on and on about the test, I was put to the test. But I passed them, I passed. Finally, after some months, I spontaneously, and I never would have predicted this, I didn't take all the practice change I took on this practice because I was so troubled by the practice of just doing for people when I didn't feel like it. So that wasn't working. That's why I did this. I never would have predicted that in some months after beginning this practice that I spontaneously offered to help somebody do something. And as a matter of fact, I did feel, I felt all full up. And I just felt willing, compelled to extend this out. So that's a very different feeling than the social politeness that I was taught and that I felt from my mom. If you all filled up yourself, so you naturally extend. And it also takes care of that problem that you're very familiar with, of helping someone. I help you. And it just takes all the help out of it. But if you're just spilling over, then it's not what you're supposed to do. The person who's allowing you to help them is doing you a service as well, and you're quite aware of it. Because you have to. Anyway, there are five major aspects of pleasure that I talk about in my workshop, and all of them are very essential to our well-being and our making of generous people and all that, but I only want to talk about one of them tonight, and that's ecstasy. And I want to talk about ecstasy. Oh, at first I want to define ecstasy very precisely, so you know what I'm talking about. I want to define ecstasy as that feeling of timeless, boundless feeling that you have when you lose your ability to discriminate. You know, it's just this wondrous state of mind when your critical mind that oppresses you so much just disappears and everything you perceive as equal weight with everything else. There is no preference for anything, just everything. It's just as it is, so wonderful. And it doesn't mean anything more. This face doesn't mean any more than that face doesn't mean any more than this picture. Everything is special unto itself. And it's boundless. It's very standing and expanding. That's totally immersed in whatever experience you're having. And because of the suspension of critical mind and how refreshing this state of mind is, we need that. I've chosen to talk about ecstasy not because it's the most important aspect of pleasure, or even the most interesting, although it certainly is interesting, but because it can be problematic. But specifically, if you are on a spiritual practice, it's related to that, or people think it's related to that. You hear a lot about ecstasy when you talk about spiritual matters. The phrase religious ecstasy reminds me. Religious ecstasy, and sometimes in workshops I've been asked, is what you're describing the same thing as, a deep spiritual state. So people do wonder about that. And that, actually, that possibility, I think, is why some people actually take up meditation. People usually enter practice, I think, from the suffering or the pain part of the pleasure-pain cycle. Because they've had the insight that there's suffering. The cause of suffering is the cessation of suffering, and the path to the cessation of suffering. And they hear cessation of suffering, that's for me. In fact, when I first took the Four Noble Truths, I was thrilled. I thought, this is it. That's why I want that. And so I came to Zen. When I heard that, I was very happy. Some people interpret their religious practices or teachings to mean that they should be in a state of bliss all the time. This is not particularly true of anything. I don't think that we're into this consciousness so much. I think that our equivalent facade to other people's bliss consciousness is equanimity. I think that's what I have great stories about bliss consciousness, but some of them. I think that when you've been practicing Zen for a while, you feel that you should be, or at least appear to be, very calm with your wounds and equanimous. New students do this all the time. I don't know who they're getting it from. But, not most. The new students, you know, are very slow and deliberate and, you know, calm, whatever they do. And this is fine until some terrible thing happens, like everybody else who saw the dessert on Friday night. And then the equanimity is disturbed. So if you prefer a state of mind, or you feel that your religious practice involves a certain state of mind, this can be very unsettling to try to claim to one to begin a state of mind. Well, I came to Zen Center because I was suffering. Specifically, Zen Center, because a man that I met was a practice who was reading The Three Pillars of Zen by Philip Catherwood, who's a Rochester Zen Center. And I don't know whether you're familiar with this book, but it describes a series of pictorial experiences. You know, the people are sitting fishing long periods of meditation, and they're miserable, and it hurts, and it's hot, and it's boring, and they try to answer the koan mu, you know, a million times, and the teacher throws them out, and they're so discouraged, and boom, they're awash. And it's wonderful. When I read that book, I said, yes! Now I don't have to take mescaline anymore. I don't have to like that. And so the study is the Tori experience. So the reason we came out here, our later married people, the reason he was the first person I ever knew to use the word cosmic in a sense. We came out here, and the reason we came out to Zen Center instead of going to Rochester is while we were visiting in Boston. And we wrote letters of inquiry to both the Rochester Zen Center and the San Francisco Zen Center. And they, you know, we were very natural food, natural everything. They wrote back a typewritten letter, and then said wrote back a handwritten letter. That was a long time ago. So we came out here with people coming. Oh my, I shouldn't spoil it. Anyway, I was going to tell you the story of my first machine that I
was going to do.
You have to learn.
Oh, I do. I can't remember. So anyway, we came out here and, you know, we didn't know anything. I mean, my boyfriend, Tony, had been studying the instructions in the back of the Catholic book, so he had said to him, but I had never said. We came out here, we went up to the front office of Zen and said, you know, how do we get involved in Zen teaching? And the woman at the front desk said, well, the only thing we had now, it was during that interim or something like that. She said, no, it couldn't have been. But there was a lull for about a week, and she said, and then we had a 5-day machine. You can do that. So I said, sure. So she said, this was on a Thursday, and she said, it starts Saturday morning on Friday night for the orientation. So we dressed in our finest hippie finery. I mean, we didn't know what this was about. We went to the orientation and we noticed everybody else was wearing these hideous drab black clothes. You know, and I had never been. Oh, all right. I had on my long paisley dress and my little velvet jacket with the rhinestones. I mean, I didn't know, never having done Zazen, I didn't know that it hurts after a while, so it was very easy for me to sign up for 5 days. Anyway, we did, we concluded the orientation with a sitting, a 40-minute sitting, down in Center before we went to bed for the night to get up at, God knows, 3:30, 4 o'clock, am I in the neighborhood? And so I don't know how I got through that 40 minutes. Oh my God. Oh. It hurt. And not only that, it was, oh boy. I couldn't wait till the bell rang.
I still feel that way after 5 years.
Well, we went out. I couldn't believe there was some method for leaving the venue. We couldn't rush out. So we get out there, and there's the schedule for the next 5 days. I elbow my way to the front. And just, I can't even. One word. Has to be interrupted occasionally by the word team. Occasionally by the word service. Now, I didn't know what service was, so I thought, there's hope there. So, I admit that this 40-minute period gave me a little pause about the next 5 days, but I thought, well, I'm tired. Well, I don't know how. The first 2 periods before breakfast the next morning was really difficult because I thought we were going to be some week. I thought I can maybe see the breakfast and then we'll have the service thing. We'll go upstairs and sit on chairs. I can look into the courtyard. I can eat. I can make it through. Well, I don't know how I did. Can you imagine? We're filing out. We're getting to the stairs, we're almost there. And then, much to my horror, everybody turns and picks up trays and goes right straight back in. I'm screaming inside, no! I'm picking up the tray, I mean, Zazen was one thing, you can mess around with my feet. Well, really terrible. So, the next day, I said to Tony, who's winning too. Now, he was having a hard time too, he'd only said a couple times, he conceded as a personal affront, as a Japanese revenge. I said, I am out of here. Once again, luck brought me to this state. I am not doing this. And he said, look, he said, I have known you for a couple of years now. He said, you are always complaining about your existential situation. He said, you're always saying you only get a handle on your existential pain. He said, now here's an opportunity just to have physical pain. He said, it's possible that if you could get a handle on this, if you could penetrate this, then you could start to get a handle on the rest of your life. So, I went back. And I even had Joseph. Oh! Jesse Roshi was very ill. He was giving the lectures that Katagiri Roshi was giving to Joseph. So he could hardly speak English. So I went into it. This is going to be my big encounter with the Zen master. The Zen master, my big encounter. I can break through it now. And that's how I go in. And, you know. So I said, I can't stand this. And no longer, I blithered on. I don't know how long until I finally ran down. And I looked at him, and he looked at me. And he said, try harder. He hadn't understood a word I said. I went back to the vendor. My only comfort was the goat fur, which used up about 50 minutes. It was awesome. But then on the third day, I'm sitting there. You know, it's like after lecture, and maybe it's after lunch and before tea. One of the worst. No, that's not the worst. But anyway, it's into the third day, and I'm sitting there. I'm okay. I check to see if my pain is still going strong. Yeah. It was still going strong, but it wasn't helping. And I looked up, looked at it, and listened. The sound of the jingle was like behind me. Everything was beautiful. I was enlightened. I must have done 1,000 dishes of meatballs. Pulled 100 of meatballs while the sun was coming over the hill in the morning. Had hundreds of conversations with other people who lived there and guest people. I was responsible for the guest program at one point. But I never paid any attention to it. I had a baby during the sun. He was often like at the edge of my consciousness. All I was focused on was that before. And before I experienced it, I was able. I finally got the hang of it, and I was able to hold on constantly for longer. And I spent, as I say, a couple of years that way, going in and out of it until I was able to stabilize for longer. Finally, I decided that this wasn't a life, these experiences. They were too far in between compared to my regular life, for one. And it occurred to me that I was going down a path, going down a golden record focus path, without looking to the left or looking to the right. Only this experience is real to me. All the other stuff